stuff.
Yeah. Jane needs to do something else. And there's certain times when it's always great. Actually, my mom was a downtown person, like, right there this month. I mean, we were there Christmas. Always took a little expensive new bag for the kids.
Mr. Charles.
Yes, that's not a touch of hand.
So, what you should have said before,
I think there's a impressionist. Is there an impressionist exhibit?
All rise. The State of Washington Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session. The Honorable Stephen J. Dwyer presiding.
You may be seated, everybody. And first up, the State versus Bonds.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Catherine Glinsky, here on behalf of Appellant Bonds. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The admission of testimonial statements from a non-testifying witness violated Mr. Bonds' right to confrontation. Confrontation is a fundamental protection in a criminal case, and it requires that evidence be tested through cross-examination. So out-of-court testimonial statements are inadmissible at trial unless the declarant is unavailable and the defendant had a prior opportunity to cross-examine the declarant. Now, whether statements made during a police interrogation are testimonial depends on the primary purpose for the interrogation. Statements are non-testimonial when the primary purpose of the interrogation, viewed objectively, is to enable the police to handle an ongoing emergency. But when the circumstances objectively viewed indicate there's no ongoing emergency and the primary purpose is to establish past events potentially relevant to a criminal prosecution, the statements are testimonial. And in this case, we have out-of-court statements by a witness who did not testify at trial. Her statements were testimonial. There was no ongoing emergency at the time that Antoinette Jordan was interrogated by police. The purpose of the interrogation was to prove past facts. The police responded to a 911 call of a domestic dispute, but when they arrived, they found no evidence that the situation was ongoing. Bonds had left at the time the 911 call was made. There were no other suspects in or around the house. There was no known or suspected threat in the house. There was no indication that anyone was seriously injured or needed medical attention. The purpose of the questioning wasn't to identify Bonds, because that was already done. It wasn't to determine if Antoinette needed to go to the hospital, because that was already done. And it wasn't to locate Bonds, because the 911 caller had already given that information to the police and the police were acting on it. The purpose of this interrogation was to find out what had happened. Now, it's particularly telling that the police gave Antoinette 5 to 10 minutes to collect herself before questioning her. They found her upstairs, they brought her downstairs, they identified her, they sat her in the living room. And she was upset, so they gave her 5 to 10 minutes just to calm down and collect herself. Now, this lack of urgency demonstrates that the police weren't gathering information to assist in an ongoing emergency. They were trying to find out what had happened. The fact that Antoinette was distressed or fearful isn't dispositive on this issue. Our Supreme Court has recognized that in some cases, like domestic assault cases, the victim may be upset for a long time after the emergency itself is resolved. So that alone is not enough, and that was sort of a crucial factor that the court looked at. The fact that the information was being relayed to police officers who were searching for the suspect isn't alone determinant.
Often with excited utterances, someone, as you say, is upset for long periods of time. But this particular circumstance, she's too upset to talk right at the time. of the commission of the crime.
And that could be relevant to whether it was an excited utterance, but the question here is whether the statements she was giving were testimonial. And the fact that she was upset, but they gave her time to collect herself, and they asked her questions, what happened, what had happened, and she responded to those questions. The officer followed up with asking more detail about what had happened. That shows that the purpose of this interrogation was to gather information about past events. It wasn't to assist in an ongoing emergency. The fact is, there wasn't any emergency. She was still frightened, but she wasn't in danger. There were police inside and outside of the house. They had already cleared the house.
So you're saying the fact that she was frightened and acting fearful that he might return or fearful for her safety is not reasonable under the circumstances?
I'm not saying that she was unreasonably fearful. I'm saying that it didn't make it an emergency situation. The police weren't talking to her to get information to get her safe, because they already made her safe. She was safe. She was in the house with police officers. There was no threat in the house. They had searched the house completely.
For how long was she safe?
She was safe during the course of this interrogation when it was being handled.
Mr. Bryant was safe when he was lying in the parking lot with his bullet wound, right? Because he was surrounded by police.
That was certainly a different situation. We had a person...
The case was a different situation, but he certainly was safe, right? If that's the standard, being safe right now because you're surrounded by police, Mr. Bryant was safe.
Well, that's the question when we're talking about fearfulness, and that's, which is what Judge Applegate was asking about.
Fearfulness has to do with whether there's an ongoing emergency.
Correct.
I mean, so maybe I mistook your argument. It appeared that you were arguing there was no ongoing emergency because she was then safe.
I'm saying that her fear didn't render it an emergency just because she was afraid.
Let me ask you a question about your second issue.
Sure.
Dealing with Mr. Tucker. There was a mistrial. And between the time that the mistrial was declared and the time that the second trial ended, I couldn't find any indication that trial counsel came forward with any more complete explication of what it is that Mr. Tucker might have testified to if he'd been allowed to testify. So are we, in fact, does the record only consist of that 1, 3, or 4 sentence statement that's in the record immediately preceding the ruling that's challenged?
Right, yes. That was when counsel raised it, and that's when the court ruled on it, and counsel did not raise it again.
So one of the things that that is then said in that proffer is that Mr. Tucker would have testified that, quote, everything that Beatrice said was a lie. Would he have been able to testify to that?
He couldn't have used those words. He could have described what he saw.
Okay, well, I guess you reached a conclusion that I'm looking for the factual basis for. What in this 3 or 4 sentences indicate something that he saw?
He was there. Counsel said he was there. There was no question that he was there.
He was there. What does he say that he saw?
What did he see? That counsel did not make a specific offer of proof to that, but did say that he explained that, you know, that Beatrice was not telling the truth, and he was there.
He can't testify to his conclusion that Beatrice is
not
telling the truth.
No, but he can testify to what he saw.
But why? I understand that we leap to the conclusion that it must be material if someone is physically present, but that usually is a predicate for something else. He was there, and he saw these things happen. I'm missing the "he saw these things happen" in this offer of proof. Is there anywhere else in the record that I'm going to find it?
No. No. What we have is counsel's admittedly brief statement, but an explanation as to why this was a material witness. What he saw was different from what he'd been hearing. Everyone who testified at trial who had been there testified that he was there.
I don't think there's a question about, I don't think there's a reasonable question as to whether or not he was a person that was present. I'm just trying to discern what he told the trial judge, what the lawyer told the trial judge that this witness would testify to that did not come into this trial. And in 10 minutes, you can answer that question.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name's Jim Schott. I'm deputy prosecutor for Pierce County. Addressing the first issue.
Let's address the second issue first, since we were just talking about it. I don't see where the trial court ruled who it was that violated the motion in limine excluding witnesses. Did the trial court find that it was the lawyer that violated the order, or did he find that it was Mr. Tucker that violated the order? And where will I find that finding?
Your Honor, in the discussion of the colloquy and reading the words that the judge used when he was making that ruling, my interpretation was that he was talking about the witness having violated the order in limine.
Okay. So where will I find the finding that the witness did that willfully?
In the judge's comments, he indicated that he believed that
he believed that he was intentionally in the courtroom. I don't think that's in dispute. It's hard to believe that someone went out for a sandwich and ended up in a courtroom. So he's intentionally in the courtroom, but where's the finding that he was willfully there in violation of an order?
Towards the end of the judge's ruling, he made some inferences from the witness's behavior, from what he had done, who he was.
No, the inferences were to go to the witness's veracity, that he was all part of a scheme. It says nothing about an order that he can't be in a courtroom. Where's the indication in the record that Mr. Tucker even knew that such an order had been entered?
None of the parties specifically addressed that. The judge inferred from what had happened.
And in fact, this was a ruling that was made the evening before, right? The afternoon before?
I believe it was made immediately after the witness. It was brought to the judge's attention.
The ruling, the order that was violated, was made the afternoon before.
I'm not sure of that.
Well,
The
record indicates that there were a series of motions in limine. They were going to delay the evidentiary hearing to the next morning. They went through the motions in limine. I couldn't find anywhere else where there were motions in limine at that time.
That sounds right.
So it was the afternoon before, and at that time, where's the indication that defense counsel knew that Mr. Tucker was actually Mr. Tucker and how to get a hold of him?
Well, to take what the defense attorney said during the colloquy, he indicated he had no idea who Mr. Tucker was to begin with.
So it's the rule in a civil case is that a witness can't be excluded unless there's some sort of a violation. The violation has to be intentional or willful. The judge has to explore lesser alternatives to excluding the witness. And the opposing party has to show prejudice. Is it your opinion that criminal defendants have fewer rights to call a witness at trial than do civil litigants?
No, I would not say
that. Okay. So would you agree then that that standard would be the same standard that would apply to the ruling that's made here?
I believe counsel went into that in her brief.
I'm asking you. Yeah. What your office's position is. I mean, you told me that you're not of the belief that criminal defendants have fewer rights to present evidence than to civil litigants, and I could say that probably you've got three people agreeing with you. So if that's the case, and if the standard in a civil case is you can't exclude a witness without a showing of an intentional violation, willfully done, an exploration of less intrusive or less severe sanctions, and a demonstration of prejudice, where do we find that in this record?
Your Honor, the judge's comments extended over several pages of the transcript where he talked back and forth with the lawyers about what had happened in front of him and what he was doing as a result of what had happened.
Yeah, he was understandably upset that he thought that this ridiculous fiasco was taking place, that somebody was showing up who'd given a false name at the scene and now wanted to testify, and he thought probably the guy was going to get up and lie through his teeth. And we might even infer that that might have been what would happen. It's probably happened before in American courtrooms. But our focus is the trial judge's ruling here, right? And I don't see any indication that even the first thing is met, that there's any finding based on any fact that Mr. Tucker himself knew that there was an order that had been made that he was violating by walking into the courtroom in a state where everybody gets to walk into a courtroom all the time. We know that, right? So where's that finding that Mr. Tucker actually had knowledge of the order that he was charged with violating?
Your Honor, I'd like to return and answer that question. And the answer to that question consists of what the judge said had happened in his presence. Now, as to when it was that Mr. Tucker walked through the doors of the courtroom and was present, whether he was there the day before or the day after, the record's silent as to that. It doesn't say one way or the other whether he was
there. Well, when you say the record's silent, you're saying that there is no finding, right? Mr. Tucker was there inconsistent with the judge's expectation based on the order he had entered. I'm asking for where the finding error is that he was there in violation of the order. And all I read is that he's there inconsistent with the judge's expectation. Am I missing something?
Well, let me answer it this way. The judge's comments as to what he did, why he did it, are in the record, and what the judge said and what he inferred from what had happened in front of him are the only findings that are there.
Okay.
He didn't enter a written order.
So let's assume that there's at least a possibility that the judge's ruling is not supported by the record. What is your position with regard to the offer of proof that was made in terms of whether or not, if that ruling was actually wrongful, whether there's a demonstration of prejudice showed to Mr. Bonds?
There's zero prejudice. And as we indicated in the brief, the full extent of what we know about Mr. Tucker and his relationship to this proceedings includes the testimony at trial, which, as the court recalls, there was a break in the trial proceedings because there was a mistrial. So there was a second trial that came. Never was Mr. Tucker's presence or a request that he testified revisited for any reason. Reading the record, what the defense attorney had during the suppression hearing was very sketchy evidence. He had run into the young man in the bathroom. He brought to the court's attention that he had been present. He said essentially what I know about what this young man would say consists of he contradicts what the officers had just testified. The judge had just made the ruling that the officers would be permitted to testify and that the evidence would be admitted. So he had already ruled on that. There was no motion to reopen that issue and permit Mr. Tucker to testify.
Would that be a jury question at trial with regard to whether the officers were testifying correctly as to what they had said that they had perceived?
Well, it would once the jury heard the testimony, but we're talking about pretrial proceedings.
Well, I'm talking about Mr. Tucker testifying at the trial, not at the pretrial motion.
So. Well, there was no indication the defense attorney was somewhat vague as to what his intentions are, probably because he didn't know what the witness would say. And at that time, whether he knew or realized that Tucker was on the jail calls, having talked back and forth with Mr. Bonds about interfering with witnesses, I don't know whether he was aware of that or not at the time this came up. It came up as a result of a chance encounter during a bathroom break during the pretrial motions. Now, what the defense attorney did is he related to the judge the fact that the witness would contradict what the officers had testified to at the pretrial hearing. But he didn't make a motion to reconsider the judge's ruling about the statements from Ms. Jordan.
Is the dispute here that the trial judge didn't allow Mr. Tucker to testify at the pretrial hearing on the preliminary question? Or is the dispute here that the trial judge didn't allow Mr. Tucker to testify at the trial?
The dispute was whether there was a constitutional violation as to whether the judge interfered with the defendant's constitutional right to call witnesses, which was briefed and is a separate issue from what we're talking about now.
To call witnesses when? You're being somewhat obtuse here, and I know you're not trying to be, but when I ask you whether we're talking about a pretrial hearing, and then I say, or are we talking about the trial, and you answer me by saying calling witnesses, that doesn't help me, because we call witnesses in both settings, right? So what is the argument that we have here? That Mr. Tucker, is it only or solely that Mr. Tucker wasn't allowed to testify at the pretrial hearing? Or is the argument, as you perceive it, that Mr. Tucker was not allowed to testify at trial?
All I can say is the defense attorney was vague as to his intentions. He asked permission to add him as a witness. I don't believe that he had filed a witness list, so he was asking orally to add the young man as a witness, and that's as far as it went. Whether he would testify at the pretrial hearing or later at trial was vague.
And then while we've got you, we had this hearing. You already had pretrial, or you already had motions in limine. Did jury selection start up right after this?
A short time later.
So this isn't a situation where we have this and 2 weeks later everybody gets back together for jury selection. We were rolling along here toward trial.
We were. I can't tell the court whether it was the same day or
Get an idea for the setting.
The jury selection started. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The record indicates that this issue came up after the court had already ruled on the suppression, whether Antoinette's statement should be suppressed. So counsel.
Right. What's your argument? Are you asserting that the error is not allowing Mr. Tucker to testify at the trial?
At trial, which is what counsel asked for. He said should be allowed to call him as a witness at least during the defense case, even though he was here for this preliminary hearing. So he's clearly making a distinction. He's not asking to reopen the preliminary hearing. And what we get from the record is that the court was concerned that Mr. Tucker was going to get on the witness stand in front of the jury and tailor his testimony to try to help Mr. Bond.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was.
So there was no...
And he made an order to try and preclude those things from
happening.
He'd entered an order.
Right.
Okay.
There was no indication that Tucker had never been on any witness list, so there was no indication that he was aware that there was an order precluding witnesses and he was not a witness. The court was upset about the way things came down, that's clear. But the court overreacted. The court said, well, this is a violation of the order excluding witnesses, so he can't testify. The court never considered alternate sanctions, less severe sanctions, never considered saying, well, okay, he can testify, but he's subject to cross-examination, not only about the fact that he lied to the police, but that he was here for this preliminary hearing. These other ways could have been addressed, even if there was a violation of an order, which the record does not establish. I think the court was really just reacting to the situation that it was bothered by. And
does any of that matter once the mistrial is declared and it's not revisited?
Well, there's no indication that the rulings that the court made before the first trial were the rulings that were in place for the second trial. So counsel did not reopen the issue, that's true. But they also didn't relitigate whether Antoinette's statements could be admitted. I mean, we went right into the next trial because of the mistrial. So that's the situation we have. We have a court's ruling saying, no, this witness is not going to be allowed to testify. And that was in violation of Mr. Bond's right to present a defense.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
State versus Hearn.